Nice to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and I especially appreciate the opportunity. Neil's offered me the opportunity to be the federal pinata up here to talk about dogfish. It's nice to see some good friends, old friends, and so forth. It's not too many old enemies, I hope. But it is an opportunity to talk about dogfish, and what I'd like to do is kind of update the scientific information on the status of the resource, and some positive news as Mills alluded to in terms of stock status and where we might go from here. It's also nice to see saw Tom DePersia on the way over, and it was good to see him too. I ruined their Christmas party for his organization several years ago. Give him a little talk there as well. But one of the things that I wanted to mention, I think we begin with kind of an appreciation for the biology of the species, and I think anybody who's worked in fisheries or fishermen, you know, does have some appreciation for the challenges that the dogfish or any fish faces in terms of persisting and earning a living. And Thomas Brown, he was kind of a second string philosopher in the 17th century there, but one of the things he said was that nature does nothing in vain, basically saying that the adaptations, the life history, peculiarities of life history of dogfish are important for the long-term persistence, as well as their response to exploitation and so forth. This was the last day this federal employee on the albatross survey. So what I'd like to do is just go over a little bit of basic biology, talk about the fishery history, not getting into too many details there, talk about the distribution patterns. This is a major source of contention between what we see on our surveys versus what fishermen say, and what I'm trying to do is kind of bridge that gap and say that, you know, basically we are seeing essentially the same kinds of patterns in terms of overall distribution patterns, particularly with respect to the female dogfish. How can we reconcile the alternative views of this resource? And then I think what is important, and perhaps one thing that this group can provide some input on, is what should a future fishery look like? You know, what kind of aspects of that are relevant to not only the biology of the species, but also its interference and externalities, if you will, with other fisheries. So, you know, begin with the basic biology. The growth curve is really kind of the underlying and probably the most important thing, one of the most important things about this resource. Female dogfish are much larger than males, and they mature at a later age. The females produce a low number of pups. They live for a long time. All the kinds of things that everyone is very familiar with. But it also, you know, when we talk about what a future fishery might look like, the fish on the left is certainly less desirable than the fish on the right, and a lot less valuable in terms of profit margin. So it's also important to kind of get a grasp of how slow spiny dogfish grow. This is average weight at age for dogfish and more popular species like charismatic species like striped bass and cod, of course, are much faster growers, and so there's a lot more potential for growth for those resources. So that also factors into the ultimate productivity and the amount that a resource can sustain. Like redfish, redfish grow slowly. They need a lot of biomass in order to produce a lower maximum sustainable yield. Dogfish are similar in that sense that they do. The amount of biomass required to support a large fishery is higher than it would be for something like cod or scup or any other more productive species. So this fishery has been characterized historically by two major pulses. The first on the left there is the foreign fishery, it was taking about 25,000 metric tons for a number of years, associated primarily with foreign, Russian trawlers and so forth. When Magnuson-Stevens Act, the 200-mile limit, was enacted, that fleet was eliminated. There was a kind of a stable period of about 6,000 metric tons a year, up to about 1989, when the second major pulse occurred. And this major pulse occurred primarily inshore, and about 95 to 99% of that was females. So it was a much different type of fishery than we think that the Russian fishery prosecuted. It's not, we don't have a lot of biological information about that aspect of the fishery, though. Historically, these are estimates of discards over time. When that large-scale fishery was in place, there were discards on the order of about 15 to 20,000 metric tons. With the change in the fishery, as well as the change in the number of days at sea, that we're hitting at about 5,000 metric tons. What I'll show next is kind of an update on sort of the distribution for the last 2 years in terms of what's going on in terms of the landings and the discards here. So this is for 2006. U.S. landings were about 2,400 metric tons. Canadians were about the same order there. And then on the right, there's sort of a breakdown in terms of discards by gear type. And then there are survival fractions applied to those. So there's about 7,500 metric tons of in the otter trawls, and about 3,000 metric tons in the gill nets. We, based on the work that Roger Rulison has done, you know, we apply a 30% survival rate, a mortality rate for discarded gillnet fish, and then the otter trawl one is about 50%, but that's not a real solid number behind that. So when you sum it all up and include the recreational, there are some fishermen who actually land dogfish, but for the most part they're discarded. And we use a 20% survival rate on that based on some other experimental work. So the 20% mortality rate, excuse me, that's it, if they retain their noses when they go back in the water. So for 2007, we have about the same kind of picture. The U.S. landings are up about 1,000 tons. 2007 is about 3,500 metric tons. Canadian landings in 2007 aren't available yet, so I just kind of assumed they're at least probably 2,000 metric tons. Put them all together, apply the discard fraction and so forth. There were about 12,000 metric tons killed of dogfish last year. So shift gears a little bit and say, okay, well, what do we see in our surveys and so forth? Neil's brought that up. We use a stratified sampling survey. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the basic concept there, is that you have, you know, strata. These are the offshore strata. We also have inshore strata, which are particularly relevant to our discussion. So I'll show you mostly data from the offshore strata first, and then I'll go back and show you some of the inshore strata as well. This is kind of a general pattern of dogfish in our spring survey. Basically along the southern flank of Georges Bank, up in the Great North Channel, hugging the Canadian line, and then some retention in the Gulf of Maine, deep waters of Gulf of Maine. But primarily, most of the resource is concentrated to the south. If you look at this in a long-term perspective, the Bay of Fundy and the approach to southwest Nova Scotia is primarily devoid of dogfish, at least historically. That was has been the case. So the coastal Maine and so forth, that area. But if you look at it in the in our fall survey, so the concentration has shifted. Those little X's there reflect those where there were no dogfish taken. So you do see a scattering on a five-year basis on the southern part of the shelf break there from Cape Hatteras north, but for the most part they're on Georges and in the Gulf of Maine, and the rest of them are in Canada. So you know, at least from what we've seen, and the Canadian distribution has a fair concentration in the Bay of Fundy, where most of the commercial fishing occurs, southwest. Yeah, hot. Yeah, I'll probably turn it off. So, as you move north and eastward along close to Nova Scotia, the population tends to diminish quite rapidly. There are dogfish in around Prince Edward Island, and it's called St. Lawrence, and perhaps Roger or somebody can add some more insight into those populations as well. But this is the basic picture of the surveys, and I think some of you have seen this type of depiction before. But what we're looking at are the size frequency distributions for different periods of time. The first one is when the fishery started, and that's so there's a pretty broad expanse of fish, and there were a lot of fish over 100 centimeters. That was, so 39 to 45 inches up there on the upper right-hand corner. As the fishery progressed, you can see the basic decrease in the numbers and abundance of those large fish. Those are the fish that are inshore and provided most of the fishery, supported most of the fishery over that period. What also happened, starting about 1997 or so, was that there, the pups, the juveniles, the immature animals below 60 centimeters basically started to, didn't show up. And of course, well, you see it for 3 years, well, you're not convinced because, maybe they're just not, recruiting to the gear, maybe they're somewhere else, maybe they've gone to Europe, for vacation or something. But, you're never quite sure where they are. But as this progressed, and what I think you can see a bit here is that as the population was being fished, the absence of recruitment here, this side of the equation started to push over. So there was compression on this side on the basis of the removals, and then depletion on this side because you didn't see the pups coming in to the recruits. There's about a 10-year period here where there's very low recruitment in this population. Now what you have is that this population is starting to move over this way, and it reflects the growth. You're also seeing a continuation of this trend. You have decreased frequencies, percentage of the population on the other side. So the population is kind of being pinched, and most of what you see is probably pretty much all the same size, 75 to 90 centimeter fish, so about 28 to 36 inches or so. And there are some hopeful signs that we are starting to see some of the recruitment once again. Alright. Watch your eyes. There it is. Okay. this would maybe be an anomaly if it was only happening with the females. Maybe there's a different behavioral pattern and so forth. But the male fishery was not really much of anything over that time period. So everything that was alive when that fishery started is pretty much alive right now. So there was very little removal in the way of the males. But you still see that same problem in terms of the absence of recruitment as well as this sort of progressive truncation. So that right now, again, that population is fairly narrowly distributed in terms of the size frequency range. Here's the overall abundance, and you can give me the book there whenever you want me to. You've had enough already, huh? Okay, yeah, I'll speed through this thing. But here's the overall biomass. This is the female spawning stock biomass. A lot of noise in this. We use smoothing. I know Dave will bring up issues related to the amount of noise. But here are the last 3 years in the survey. These are scaled units, so this is an approximation. We haven't gone through the sort of the vetting of the scientific information that will occur in the next few weeks when we go to the plan development team or the technical committee of the ASMSC and so forth. And what do we call it, Jim, what do we call the Mid-Atlantic Technical Committee? Is that technical committee? Monitoring committee, yeah. Yeah. We all kind of do the same thing. The scientists show up and the managers, and then we summarize the information. But this is kind of the the new picture that's emerging here in terms of this level of abundance. You can also see some indication that level of abundance, that increase that's occurring, is coming at the expense of those that are growing up. So these are dogfish that are, you know, sub-adults. These are 36 to 79 centimeter fish. So as this thing has bottomed out and is coming upward, this increase is coming from this decrease. That is, they're growing. It's like pigging the python. They're moving up the population. Here's the picture for recruitment. This is that absence of recruitment that is going to be an issue in terms of restoration and recovery and termination of all that. So, and this is just the males. I can go through this, but you know, it's essentially showing basically a flatline process for male abundance here over time. Here's the consequence of that change in the fishery. This is the ratio of males to mature males to mature females. Theoretically, you expect it to be about 2-to-1. A lot of sharks have multiple paternity when they've done DNA tests on clutches of sharks. There's multiple paternity. The males mature early for a reason. And the expectation is that it should be about 2-to-1 on the basis of, you know, they're maturing about 5 years earlier than the females at a smaller size. So there's a lot more of them around that are mature than females. What's happened with the removal process is that all those mature females are taken out. The sex ratio of the mature males weren't. So it's kind of Brokeback Mountain out there. For a while, with a lot more females, or a lot more males than females, and that seems to be somewhat reversing itself. This is just kind of a rebuilding scenario. These are projections from models, but the salient point here is that the population has been projected to increase and then decline. This decline in here, this wave, is associated with that absence of recruitment. That is the debt that needs to be repaid. For the longer term. So here's I said I'd get back to some of the issues in the nearshore environment here, and everyone says, well, what is this, some figment of your imagination? How come we all see males and so forth? Well, here's what we see in the survey. This is the spring survey, 5 year period here. The red are our toes that we've made, where the composition is 75% or more female. The dark blue are the toes where we see 75% or more males, and then there's kind of a mix in between those two. But the important point is that you do see the nearshore concentrations in the spring. They're in the south. There's still fairly high concentrations around Massachusetts is kind of a dogfish magnet for year round now, and you know there could be, and definitely there are distributional changes going on. In the fall, that pattern shifts. Again, we see very high concentrations inshore along the coast and so forth, but not until you get offshore on the Georges and the South Channel do you see the changes towards greater abundance of the male dogfish. And this is our winter survey, which has since been discontinued, but you can see very high concentrations of males along the shelf break and potentially offshore as well from that. This is just our survey. Does that make any sense? We've looked at the observer program. There are, you know, tens of thousands of observer days over time, and over hundreds of thousands of dogfish measured. Now this graph isn't particularly good because the blue is kind of occluding the females underneath there, but there's much higher density. But you can see, again, kind of a general pattern of that. And if you look at it in a little more detail, if you take a look at those observations, go distance from shore, here's what the survey is seeing. You know, it's about 80% females and then if you go offshore, it drops to about 30 to 40% as you move offshore. The observers see almost exactly the same pattern. About 40 nautical miles offshore, it's down to about 40% you know, males and females. So a future fishery for focused on males would primarily have to be an offshore fishery. Of course, that's a big problem, I know. Here's the pattern of, and I know I'll give you copies of all these things that we can make them up. I have a few extra copies of my presentation as well, if you want them. But what we are seeing in the fall, we're seeing an increasing proportion of the total biomass that we have estimated for this resource occurring inshore. So now it's about 40%. This is on the inshore strata that's, you know, within 3 miles of the shoreline there. So about 40%. So this, it's definitely a distributional change. Maybe it's like short stopping in geese and golf courses and stuff. But, you know, there is a different perspective here. So any future fishery, you know, as I said, there is, from the stock assessment standpoint, from the standpoint of where we go from here, the stock is approaching a rebuild status on a technical level, but there will be a payback for the 90s low recruitment period. The stock should remain high for another 10 years. So what's the best way to handle that? So I think that's an important focus for this group, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. So in the future of this resource, the sustainability really is going to be directly linked to the production, you know, that is the production of pups from this. So, you know, a 10,000-ton fishery probably is something in the longer run, you know, is something that is possible, whether or not, you know, and it's not something that you'd want to slam into right away, I don't think, given markets and infrastructure and all those kinds of things. So, you know, it's just a good opportunity to think about it. And, you know, these are just some questions, and maybe if you want, you can come back to them later, but, you know, what a future fishery would look like. But it's basically biological aspects, the fishery aspects, you know, what's the economics, and that's really quite important. I mean, you don't have fisheries in vacuums, obviously. And then, of course, what are the regulatory requirements? And so there's the other part. So, anyhow, thank you. I don't think I went too long over it, or did I? Am I okay? Okay, good. Well, thanks. And if there's questions, I'd be happy to. Greg?
Dr. Rabel, I have a couple of questions.
Call me Paul, I said.
If you could go back to your third to the last slide, which I guess was future fishery.
Yeah.
What is your bullet number four there, your opinion that 5 to 8 years, 10 years, that the stock will begin to decline?
Well, that's coming from this projection. You know, it's basically saying that depending upon what type of fishing mortality that's applied to this thing. You know, there's two parts of it, obviously. There's a discard fraction that's basically unavoidable, you know, and then there's a directed fishery. And in the past, the discarding has gone up with the directed fishery. That's primarily because it was very selective, because there was, a fair amount of, selection for broad backs and big bellies, you know, and females and so forth. But in any case, if the fishery, there's a couple of projections we've made, and all of them show this basic pattern, is that it would be approaching, rebuilt status, you know, essentially we're around this level here, so by 2009. But the idea is that payback period for those, that low recruitment stanza there, is needs to be paid back. So that's why it should stay up. And then as those fish that are there now grow up and just die from natural mortality, that stock will begin to decline. You can see that right now in terms of, you know, what that female population is doing. This cluster of fish is getting smaller. You know, so this thing is moving this way. You know, so that's sort of the basis for it. You know, and then if we can get additional information from fishermen on these size compositions, I mean, Jimmy Rules would say that they would seem in the squid fisheries, you know, at the shelf break, and that's where we do see them. I think there's a, it's hard to, produce. Yeah, here's the distribution of pups. Yeah, it's less than 36 centimeters. So they're basically southern flank of Georgia's all along here. This is in the spring. The small ones, I know they're found in some of the shrimp fisheries in the Gulf of Maine at different times of year.
So, but the decline will be from two sources: a low recruitment event and additional mortality, fishing mortality.
Correct. Okay. Right. But mostly, most of that is coming from the low numbers of recruits.
Okay.
In historic, right. So you've got to, you know, the future is pregnant with the present, and vice versa.
And one last question, I think. There was also a graph you had there of, I think, the spring fishery only, showing relative rates of female versus male.
This is our, this is
the number, graph.
Not the photograph. This one?
Yeah, do you have a fall?
No, I don't.
Is it similar?
Or
the fall survey?
The fall survey is kind of problematic because it's only capturing part of the resource. You know, a lot of the resource is in Canada, that during that period of time. That's why there is a move to have a joint assessment, and it's going to be done as beginning in January, February through the what's called the TRAC process. That's the transboundary assessment, something. there's a lot of this. Everything we have is four-letter acronyms. So it's TRAC, SARC, YARN, etc.
The industry has some four-letter acronyms.
Yeah, I know. I heard
a little different.
I know. We're off the wagon. I've seen it so many times when I come to meetings.
The shirts are in the car. Don't worry about it. Does the ratio, though, track similar?
Or is it the ratio for through, I haven't updated it for the last 3 years, but it has tracked, and that there is a greater abundance of males to females. Yeah. So
thank you.
But I'll check it. I'll make sure. And also come to the meeting whenever it's December or October 16th, whatever.
Thank you.
Another delightful day in the province.
Yeah.
Jim?
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate your presentation and your coming here. What did you say to be a pinata? That was good. I'm glad you brought up that slide just before with the distribution of pups.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting because I actually had brought a copy of that slide with me.
Because
it appears when you look at that, and you look at all of the distribution of dogfish or any species, that there's an invisible fence there. There's a dog fence out there. Electrically, no dogfish can go east of that or deep of that.
Probably.
Okay? And as me and Jimmy Rule many times brought up the point where there's 10 to 20 toes on her survey deeper than 100 fathom.
That's right.
Okay?
Right.
And when you look at the dogfish distribution of pups, you see how there's hardly any of them inshore. And as you get deeper, now you start picking up the concentration of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we had said many times, we've seen toes, 5,000-pound toes of puppies, this big, worse than you'd ever put on your deck,
because
they don't move, you can't shovel them, there's too many of them to pick up by hand, you know, you stick a hose in them, they go nowhere. Okay, it's a disaster. You don't want to, and you don't even want to bring them on the boat. So yeah, consequently, obviously you don't want that. Okay,
right, right.
But that's in 150, 200 fathoms of water. Okay, why is that? Okay, because there's no predation down there. That's the safety zone for these animals,
right.
And there they are. Yet we do no surveys down there.
Right.
Okay. Now we have tagging studies showing dogfish down to 2,500 feet, mature dogfish down to 2,500 feet. We have global warming taking place, and the temperatures are changing. And I think there's a lot of fish species are going deeper off the shelf at this point. Okay, we're seeing it with scup, we're seeing it with squid, we're seeing it with dogfish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How does that play into a stock assessment? I mean, you're looking at same old toes, same old areas, okay, and you're missing all of the pups that are in the deep water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and
I
just
I will agree with that. There may be a lot of offshore. Definitely.
When you're less than 10% of your toes are in the deep water, okay, you're not getting an accurate stock assessment. All right, and it's specifically because generally what I've seen are those pups are Hudson Canyon south and probably a little bit east. I don't know how they are up to the north of there or east of there, but there's a big area there, and there's really one or two toes made there per year. Okay, so you're missing the whole thing, and if you're not there at the right time, you're not catching them either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so consequently, yeah. And you can see in the recruitment there, you look at the spikes. Dogfish school, just like stuff.
Yeah.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Every once in a while, you got a couple of big toes, and you got these huge spikes.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know,
right.
Great recruitment.
Exactly, yeah.
Average it out and see what you got. Yeah, there's no question.
Right,
yeah,
right.
If you catch all the big female, you're going to affect recruitment.
Right, right.
You know?
And
but how are we going to address what conceivably, okay, what very likely, I would think more than 50% probability in my book is a missing of the dogfish biomass.
Right.
Now we know by West Coast, British Columbian dogfish stock was depleted in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Totally recovered by 1960. And the scientists there figured that stock doubled every 9 years.
That's about what we apply. You know,
right.
I mean, the analysis I did for the survey, the original plan, you know, had about the same growth rate as they did on the West Coast. You know, it's about 5 or 6% per year. Even
that was 8% on the West Coast.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a much bigger, more productive animal too.
Yes,
so.
It is. Yeah. Yeah,
it's you know much.
But what do we do though with your? If the science is wrong, we already have too many dogfish according to anybody that's on the water, okay, and including your own scientists here. When you happen to have a 10,000-pound toe and you rip your bag up and so forth, you know, and
yeah,
we're sure,
just like
who said there's no dogfish?
Yeah,
you know, but you went from 20% dogfish back in the early 60s. Okay, so over 50% now. Something's not right here.
Well, I mean,
total biomass.
Right, right.
Something's not right. When you go from an ecosystem carrying only 20% dogfish to over 50%, something's out of whack. You want to keep a biological target that high where you have an ecosystem teeming with dogfish, half of the ecosystem is full of dogfish. How do you recover the other size?
Right. Well, I mean, I mean, there's a lot of questions in there. I don't know.
There's a lot. I mean, you probably need other people to be bringing their presentations
and so
forth.
Right, right.
And then we're
going to
nail it.
Yeah,
don't go early.
I got an early flight. I forgot to nail that. I got a new flight. Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah.
Well, thanks. What was the... Do we have any idea of what the historical levels of this species were before the Russian trawlers got a hold of them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. No, we really don't. You know, the surveys really started approximately when right after the, you know, sort of the or coincident with the Russian fleet. There were industrial fisheries for which there were reported landings in the 50s, but that's pretty loose stuff. You know, there's not a lot of extrapolation that you can do with it. Even for the composition of the Russian fleet information there, Emory Anderson and there were a number of programs after the collapse of the Soviet Union to go to Tallinn and actually look at the official records for that pattern of removals, and they're basically locking them up in ice and shipping them back to the motherland. The records that were there were pretty much the same as the records that they had submitted to NAFO. You know, it was basically unclassified. Dogfish, and that was basically a protein.
So, what the purported record numbers that commercial fishermen are seeing now is not necessarily a tremendous increase in biomass across the board, but it's reflected in a change in distribution of the females closer to shore than it ever has before, and so they're piling up against the shoreline, and we're catching them in interstate fisheries. Is that
well? I mean, I think that they're definitely inshore. There's definitely from the work that Sims and others have done in, with Carolina in Ireland. You know, there's a lot of spatial segregation between males and females, and they have some hypotheses about why that occurs, and that could be part of it, but it could be food sources. Maybe they're concentrating on haddock and herring and so forth, herring and mackerel, excuse me. But you've got herring or haddock are doing fairly well right now. So
I'm trying to get at this question of, you know, we see all these dogfish and everybody says that there's so many, but yet your surveys would indicate that they're for whatever reason, being pushed or approaching the shoreline and getting involved in more of the inshore fisheries than they ever have in the past.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what this would suggest. I mean, this is through 2005. But, you know, it's gone from, you know, basically about a nominal level, a few percent, 5% in that period to, you know, 30-40% in recent years. So they're definitely a much higher fraction of that biomass is inshore, you know, in the summer, fall period there. You know, whereas this is a spring survey in the inshore composition. It's just a few percent. But even this is sort of the increased retention that's occurring in recent years. So this is aggregated north south. It's not doesn't include the other. So thanks. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yep. Jim.
Excuse me. When you ask the question, make comment. Could you identify yourself, please?
All right. Jim Logan, Fishermen.com. Paul,
do you have this slide here?
Not all the way back. No, I was trying to pare that set down. So, yeah, but it's right. It does show that longer term increase.
Let me point this out because you didn't get an answer there when you asked if there's an increase in the biomass of dogfish. And the original trawl survey started 64. This graph goes back to 67. There was less than 200 metric tons of biomass of total dogfish. Okay, 50,000 metric ton was estimated as female spawn and biomass, okay? By 1980, it was over 600,000 metric tons. There was a tripling of the dogfish biomass in 15 years, okay? That was coincidental with the depletion of the groundfish stocks on Georgia's banks. This is documented by Steve Morawski, okay? The takeover to Georgia's banks by Alaskan branches. The dogfish population is artificially high. The biological target is set at that artificially high level, and they are attempting to keep it there, knowing that you can't do it. That's why I brought up to 20% originally and 50% or more now. How many dogfish want an ecosystem if you want to have any other fish in it? If you want to keep dogfish where they're at, you will never recover the other stocks of the fisheries, plain and simple. But yeah, the dogfish population is 3 times higher than it was when they originally did a survey before the Russians started fishing. Okay? There wasn't any fisheries. It was minimal, 6,000 metric tons a year.